Wednesday, May the 10th, was a tremendous day. Early breakfast with Lyndon, a second cup of coffee, sitting on the bed with Jewel and Betty and Jessie, and outlining their possible sightseeing. I suggested Fredericksburg, Monroe's law office, and Mrs. Washington's home, and Betty Washington Lewis's home, and possibly a stop back by Gunston Hall. And Jessie Hunter said she'd like to go to Washington's birthplace, too. And then, with Liz and Poulaine, on the Eastern Airlines shuttle to New York at 10 o'clock, arriving in the Carlisle suite at 11:20. There was time for calls to plan the next day's work and lunch and dress. And then, about 1:30, we left for Carnegie Hall for the first of the two big events of the day. Only in the life of a politician could a day like today happen. Two big events aimed around opposite poles of America's life. The first, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. They're retired members, average age probably 70. And the second, the Head Start program, which involves youngsters 4 and 5, mostly from culturally deprived families. I'd waked up this morning to see the most marvelous full-page ad in the New York Times, which read, "From Sweatshops to Tuskowski." And it was a triumphant telling of the progress of labor. From lofts and long hours to leisure and Stokowski and even a first lady, I was mentioned. Under the aegis of David Dubinsky, the retired president, they've got a program for spending those leisure hours, which involves educational and cultural projects, visits to a vacation spot. This concert is one of a series. As I stepped out of the car at Carnegie Hall, I thought I heard a slight hissing noise behind me, but I did not turn around. If there were bearded faces and placards, I certainly wouldn't turn around to add to the attention they were getting. If they were in front of me, I think I would walk through with a smile saying hello. And there on the sidewalk was David Dubinsky, the retired president, the reason I had come. To me, he's a fascinating man, passionate advocate of his people, great actor, great friend. And Mr. Stuberg, the present president of the union, who has a difficult role following in his shoes. We found our seats in a box with Mr. Stuberg's wife and David Dubinsky's daughter, and Arthur and Dorothy Goldberg, enormously popular with these people. And then began two wonderful hours for many reasons. Carnegie Hall was packed, 3,000, the balconies rising row on row, full, even to the top peanut gallery. And down below, a few determined old ladies were marching down the aisle, searching for their seats, berating the ushers and grumbling, and all but getting into a fight with the persons that they thought had their seats. It was like a Molly Goldberg show. And then Stokowski came on in a swallowtail coat and a great big striped cravat, his white hair flowing, every inch the showman himself. But for me, he met his match in David Dubinsky. Stokowski waited, his delicate hands poised in the air like a fluttering bird. Almost 5 minutes passed. Finally, Stokowski said, "A painter paints his pictures on canvas, but musicians paint their pictures on silence. We provide the music, and you provide the silence." It was delicious drama. The program was made up of favorites. Wagner, and then Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, and then the wild romantic music of Gypsies, the Romanian Rhapsody by Ionescu. And I was caught up and borne along on the stream of the music, understanding it not really very much, but held in its sway, and watching the people. There was one Negro woman who had 4 drums in front of her. She would be absolutely motionless for 5 or more minutes, and then she would suddenly attack all 4 drums in a frenzy. And an old man with a white beard who played the cello and had almost as much presence and dignity as Stokowski himself. Then came the intermission. David Dubinsky was the first speaker, and it was his audience and his moment. And as the New York Times said, the gold and white splendor of Carnegie Hall sounded more like a union hall. He reminded the audience of the 50-year or so struggle of the labor unions. Little did you think in those days of the sweatshops and the picket lines. And he quoted the times when they had worked 12, 15, 18 hours a day, that one day you would be sitting in Carnegie Hall with the First Lady. It's a long way from those days to Carnegie Hall.
And
he talked about a strike of 1912 or 13. And I could see old heads bobbing through the audience in memory. It was a great show, and I was glad I was there to watch it. So I had the feeling that these battles are won. This day is over. This is the last hurrah. You are not forgotten people, he went on. We won't forget you, neither the Union nor the government. And Mr. Stuhlberg spoke with dignity and briefly. I do believe David Dubinsky would have pulled him by the coattails if it had been long, and Stokowski himself very briefly. And then David introduced me fulsomely. I gave a plug to the Great Society, to Lyndon's work, the Medicare law, and the Older Americans Act. Our goal is not merely to prolong our citizens' lives, but to enrich them, and praise the Union for starting this program, cultural and educational projects. And a salute to old folks. What the world would have missed if Conrad Adenauer had not worked in his 70s, and Winston Churchill from 65 on, and Eleanor Roosevelt in her senior years, and Grandma Moses through her 80s, and if Maestro Stokowski had laid down his baton at 65 or so. And express my admiration for David and Mr. Stuhlberg and all those who had let me share this exciting, hopeful look into the new world. The last number on the program was Dvorak's symphony called The New World. And indeed, a new world is opening up for old folks. When I finished, one of the retirees of the ILGWU, dressed in her best and savoring this moment, came up to me with a big bouquet of yellow roses, which she gave to me with a wonderful little speech that she and all of them loved my husband, were his strong supporters, and were going to work hard for him in 68. Then Stokowski took over for the last number, the great rolling music of Dvorak's Ninth, that keeps on repeating two themes. One of them, I believe, a spiritual that goes, coming home, coming home. It was familiar. I loved it. I was exhilarated. And David Dubinsky kept on whispering in my ear things about the program. But the first line at the top was in Hebrew, translated below as a verse from Psalms. Cast me not off in the time of old age. Forsake me not when my strength faileth. And went on to say that half the people in the audience could read it in the Hebrew. That the Union had begun as almost solid Jewish, with a later invasion by the Italians and now the Negroes. He pointed out proudly the Negro faces in the audience. The program also had a very good picture of Lyndon and quotes from his speeches about the older American. Just before it was over, I could hear a brisk exchange between David and Mr. Stuhlberg behind me. I found out with amusement later that it was a question of whether the orchestra was going to finish within the allotted time or whether they were going to have to start paying time and a half by Union law. They finished with 3 minutes to spare. We cheered Stokowski back onto the stage. Again and again, I had met him during the intermission. And the audience cheered me too and waved at me and blew kisses. And I waved back. And then we left. And with enthusiastic goodbyes to David and Mr. Stuhlberg, I was off to the Carlisle. The time to rest just a little. It always surprises me that I got actually physically tired from an attempt to project, to give out, to express warmth to a crowd of people. And then a hairdo with Jack, my old friend from Eddie Sands, and into my red lace dress for the second big event of the day. Liz had taken out a little insurance for the papers. She does this so skillfully by having, about noontime, a little group of officials and mothers of the Head Start program and three of the little children in a Head Start class, one a Negro, one a Latin American, and one white child, come up to the suite for a few minutes' talk and pictures. They had brought me some of their work from their Head Start class, mostly finger painting. They were pretty tongue-tied, and I tried valiantly to talk to them. Actually, I thought I did pretty well, to the tune of clicking cameras and listening ladies with pads. This was so the papers with deadlines could have a picture if they wanted to use it, and they did. And then with Liz, I left for the Hotel Pierre for the reception and dinner given by the Citizens Committee for Children. Mrs. Melton Gordon, a quietly handsome, slender woman, the head of the organization, met me and took me to the Sapphire Room for pictures, the format with which I am now quite familiar. News photographers and reporters lined up ahead of time to get the picture for that deadline. But this time, the citation was not a piece of paper or a bronze plaque. It was instead many little glass terrariums with enchanting little gardens inside, made of ferns and plants, some that bloom. They're even going to have some little live things in them, salamanders. Too bad they couldn't be frogs. And one would be given to each Head Start classroom in the city, so that these children could watch things grow and perhaps become familiar with some of the names. It was an imaginative award in which I took much delight. 350 of these little terrariums in all. Then we went into the reception where I met some of my old friends like Henry Diamond and Bob Stein, and we talked of Linda and the Ed Weisels, both Molly Parnas and Adele Simpson, and those who would sit on the dais with me. Arthur Goldberg's gang, I wonder if they ever eat at home, and Mary Lasker, beautiful in a pink brocade. A whole spectrum of people interested in children and their welfare. Social workers, philanthropists, opinion makers, judges and politicians and educators. The Frank O'Connors and Mrs. Marshall Field, she said she had sent me word about not being able to come to the Committee for the Preservation of the White House. Dr. Leona Baumgartner. Dave Dubinsky, grinning like a little elf, still radiant with the success of the afternoon. Jean Kentner. The Arthur Krems with their British friend. Bob Wagner and his wife, looking younger and happier than he did 5 years ago. And Ed Warburg's, she's the mother of Stephen Currier, in black, looking sadly distant from it all. He told me it was very hard for the scar tissue to heal because over and over they would hear reports of another body being washed up on the beach, and it was required for someone to go and try to identify it. As I looked out at the audience of 700, I knew I was seeing a large part of the power structure of New York as oriented toward the legal and educational and social rights of children. What a society we are. I wonder if in all the world there's anybody quite like us. I wished I were a sponge and could have picked up more of what there was in that room. The brains, the hopes, the work and experiences in the past of so many of these people. Our delicious dinner was interspersed every few minutes by our very amusing master of ceremonies, Mr. Austin McCormick, whose dry wit it took me a little while to get used to. We got off to a good start because he was a friend of Edwina Mitchell's. He'd known her in penal work and thought her a great woman. The tall, affable young mayor, John Lindsay, and his wife had come to pay their respects to the committee and to welcome me. But he was also on his way to the salute for the seasons, so after one course, he arose, greeted me in a warm and cordial way, and then was off for his second course. What a life it must be. My last choice for a job in politics would be mayor of New York. And then, Nelson Rockefeller, who is fast getting to be my favorite governor, next to John, and who had come over to greet me the moment he'd spied me, to express in his warm, highly personal way his interest in Lyndon, his approval of the course he was taking, some words about Lawrence and their last meeting, and his regret that he had to leave early, but he was going to a brotherhood dinner where his own brother, the governor of Arkansas, was receiving an honor. They are so thoroughly charming, he and Happy both. Mrs. Milton Gordon made the introduction of me without a single note, with great presence and grace, a very impressive woman. I was drawn to her. For 24 years, she has worked with this committee in everything affecting the interest of children, in legislation, sometimes for, sometimes against. Jack Valenti had told me about her, had urged me to accept this award, had mentioned her husband's friendship for Lyndon in the last campaign. And then, with bright lights and TV and cameras, I was on. I tried to make my few words personal, recalling the scene in the Red Room of the White House only 2 years ago, when Head Start actually came to birth, when Sarge Shriver and about 30 of us were sitting around,
and Tony
Celebrezze told the great story of what
his
life had been channeled towards success in his teenage years
by the same
sort of guidance we're hoping to furnish now in some of the poverty programs. And that was the beginning of Head Start and the Job Corps and community action programs. And then I listed the well-known results of the medical examinations in the little over 2 years that Head Start has been going on, and how it has touched the lives of 1,400,000 children, and told them about Pancho and his visit to the White House. I wish they could all see the movie. And then a salute to their work, which has gone on so much longer than the government's, and upon which the governments can build. I tried my very best to draw from it all I could in delivery, and when I sat down, I felt I'd done fairly good, really. They were most generous in their applause. And then Trudy Lash, who had been Mrs. Roosevelt's last secretary, rose and introduced the real speaker of the evening, Thurgood Marshall. I had not heard him before.
He began in a quiet manner,
but pretty soon I realized I was in the presence of an orator.
I was proud that he was in the administration,
and Mr. McCormick lent the evening just the right amount of humor
and a sort of
fae touch.
All during the evening,
especially the reception, several people had come up to me, sort of shaking their heads and saying, "I don't see how you stand it. It's too bad." Sort of apologetic remarks that made me know that
my ubiquitous
pickets were somewhere outside, but I had not seen a one.
And it was
only in the morning papers that I found that they had been chanting outside with such slogans as, "End the war in Vietnam, bring the boys home. Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?"
This group
called themselves the Women's Strike for Peace.
They were at one entrance,
we went in another.
But their purpose was accomplished
because the press was there to duly record them.
Sometime during the dinner,
Liz brought me a folded note which said, "The Secret Service is afraid there is one woman in the audience who may arise and say, 'Stop the war in Vietnam.'"
You better be thinking about what you will answer. It did not happen.
Actually, one can become inured to this sort of thing.
We are so close to it,
I cannot see it in perspective. This era of turmoil and frustration and anger that we live in.
In the shadow of danger,
and also in the midst of the utmost affluence, opportunity, hope that the world perhaps has ever known. We were out early, thanks to Mr. Austin McCormick.
Left
a little past 10.
And I left
with the amused thought that I wondered how many more dinners poor Nelson Rockefeller and Jake Javits and Mayor Lindsay had attended.
One of the chief
qualifications for such jobs must be a good digestion.
Back at the Carlisle,
I read and worked on paper until midnight.